This is FM 2.0 with the Don, Dean, Stormy, and the Grizz. Forever music.
Everybody, welcome to FM 2.0. The Don and Dean are here, and we have a legend with us, and he's been with us before, and he's awesome. Steve Hackett. How are you, Steve?
Very good. Nice to talk to you guys. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. You know, I just have to say this side note here. I was watching, Dean, you're going to have to help me. The guitarist, it's Chris Shiflett, is in Foo Fighters, right? It's Chris Shiflett's the guitarist in Foo Fighters. I always slipped on that one. Well, he was with Alex Lifeson. And when he was asking Alex who his influences are, his first one he said was Steve Hackett.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, I'm a big Rush guy. And, right. You know, that's just the influence you've had on people that even we've, over the years, it's just amazing how that works.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, I get these things where, you know, people mention me as an influence, and I'm often very surprised, you know, that, I mean, you know, you grow up thinking, you know, my influences were somewhere between Andre Segovia and Jimi Hendrix, just to mention two. And, you know, poles apart, but I know that, various people I've worked with, and they say I was an influence on them, and I think, how is that possible? I can't be that old. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's what happens. You know, Brian May was quoted there, and Eddie Van Halen, and you know, some of these guys I've worked with. Other times, you know, you think, oh, I never got to connect with Eddie, but he said a lot of nice things. And conversely, I said a lot of nice things about him. And, of course, you know, we've had the passing of some extraordinary legends in the British department. The loss of Jeff Beck was huge for us guitarists. But it's an extraordinary thing because, you know, whenever Jeff brought out an album, every guitarist on earth was thinking, what's he going to do next? What's he's going to beat us to the punchline? And now, of course, it's up to who else is left. But what a legacy he left behind. You know, I think before him, you know, you wouldn't have had feedback, distortion, echo, all of those things. But
Well, I'll share with you why I think you are such a legend. And I've said this before. I would say you are probably the greatest in terms of all the different styles you've brought together and shown how you can make them work. And for me, you know, I can share my story, which I think is probably the same for everybody. When you just said, you know, your classical influence going all the way up to Hendrix, that was the thing for me. I mean, back in the late 70s, going to the early 80s, I was quite comfortable being a metal guitarist until my uncle gave me a huge box of vinyl albums. And I've talked about this on Sirius XM. Where in that box, there was Rush, Yes, Genesis, up until probably the Duke album. And of all the guitarists, you know, I listened to Howe and Lifeson. You, though, you showed me that as a guitarist, I didn't have to be one-dimensional, that I could listen to everything. And so I did. I went out there and started listening to everything. And it really kind of crashed my identity as a guitarist, because up until that point, I thought, well, I'm a metal guitarist. And then it became, I don't know what the hell I am, because I love it all.
Yeah. Well, it's a funny thing, you know, you go listening to someone and what happens is that if you're lucky, you think you understand an instrument and then someone comes along and makes you realize that it's being totally reinvented. I'm thinking of people like Jaco Pastorius with bass, turning it into a lead instrument, and Paul Butterfield with harmonica. I don't know, you know, what is the purpose of an instrument in the first place? You know, it's a mouthpiece. It's as if it was the human voice, but then it goes beyond that as well. You know, who knows what dreams may come, of course.
Yeah, so if I were to say that you are number, because, you know, we love our lists. We always love to put lists out there, Page, Hendrix, and I do love Hendrix. Don't get me wrong with that. But if I were to say, no, Steve Hackett should be looked at as the one because you've blended so many styles, what would you say to that?
Well, I'd say that when I was growing up listening to Andre Segovia plays Bach, I was thinking that, yes, maybe I've got a future in rock and roll, but it's not going to involve any of this influence. So this is, listening to this is a guilty pleasure. And then I realized that it didn't have to be a guilty pleasure. Early days of Genesis incorporated quite a lot of 12 strings. So we used to say that if there was a guitar-based tune, it normally meant that you had a number of 12 strings all chiming away. And then I thought maybe I could do the same for nylon guitar. If I could incorporate nylon guitar, classical guitar, into Genesis, when we were starting to be considered not just on the edge, but also mainstream, the mainstreaming of Genesis, that perhaps more people would follow with that. So I noticed it cropped up more with other people's stuff. Talking about mainstream, you know, the occasional bits of, you know, stuff from Sting and Madonna and what have you, and nylon guitar started to have its say on otherwise, you know, rock orientated stuff, but it was another color. It was the equivalent of, for keyboard players, piano, they will say, yes, you know, I can get more tone colors out of a piano. But I would say for guitarists, yeah, you'll get more tone colors out of a nylon guitar. That doesn't seem obvious at first when you hear it and you think, oh, well, this is just dull. But then, okay, you're using the nails, you play up by the bridge, the metallic strings, the bass strings can be made very, very brassy, and the top strings very mellow. But then again, if you're a flamenco player, you can lay into that and you can fire off salvos with nylon as well. It all depends on your tone, the attack, and many other things. So I think that it's possible that it may have a future as a rock instrument. It hasn't been fully explored yet, but we're heading that way.
It's funny you say that. Literally, I've got the guitar right behind me. One of the first things I did is I ran out and grabbed nylon strings and I put them on the guitar behind me as I was getting into your material. So yeah, the nylon string did have an impact on me.
I mean, when I was a kid, we did the converse, because I think that when you're young, you're obsessed with treble. There's no doubt about it. You can't get enough of it. And a friend of mine had this nylon guitar that he bought for the equivalent of about $5. Guitars were cheap in those days. Of course, I convinced them to put metal strings on it, and that worked fine for about a year or so. And then one fine day, the bridge came off completely. It was a sorry about your guitar, but it was an extraordinary thing. It was a lovely instrument, and I had lots of fun with it. And nylon just felt so extraordinary under my fingers when I first tried it. I thought, oh, this is cheating, you know, this doesn't feel like the usual barbed wire of steel strings. I thought you had to suffer and have open wounds for all those years when I started. And then nylon came along and I thought, oh, this just feels like sensuous silk beneath my fingers. This is lovely. You know, you can caress this. This will work. But it was very different, you know. Electric guitar. Yes, we know they're shaped the same, but as we're talking guitars, and I see you have quite a few there in the background, Dean. You know,
I do.
It's a completely different instrument. Yes, you could play it the same way, but I think to get the most out of nylon and acoustic in general, you can start out as a plectrum player, but eventually the nails on the hand, they start to grow almost against your best instincts. You think, it's unmanly. It's like someone, like a guy doing knitting. We don't do that kind of stuff. But then I realized that if I wanted to be able to do more than one thing and to be able to play like Segovia, it seemed like he hardly moved, and yet all these notes were coming out, was because the right hand was being incorporated. So once you get those finger style maneuvers together, and I know there's a big resistance. There was certainly a resistance in my mind for quite some time. And I thought, no, I'm going to yield to this. I'm going to try it. I can do a few things. Yeah, the forefinger gives way to the forefinger and the thumb for claw hammer type stuff. Mm-hmm. And then for a triplet figure, you get the three fingers going. And then someone will show you something with. This is assuming you don't have a guitar teacher, but you're just picking up on what people can do, and you think, he can do that, I can do that, given time, of course.
Yes, agreed.
Love it. Well, you are currently, you're in Connecticut right now, aren't you?
We are in, well, we're actually in Boston right now. So we're headed off to New London, I believe it's called.
Yes, at the Great Arts Center tonight. How are you feeling about the post tour so far? You've done about 5-6 shows now in. How are you feeling?
The tour's been amazing. The band have been amazing, and it gets more amazing every night as we take more and more chances and we realize how we can all fly with our instruments at this point. And I've gotten to the point where, you know, there's a lot of arranged stuff and you take a lot of care with that. But when you come to improvised moments, and there are a few, or more than a few, I realize we can all take huge chances on that. And so I really look forward to those moments live where it isn't the same every night, like the intro to Devil's Cathedral with Rob and Roger. It's completely different every night, but they're playing scales that sound like they're written. It sounds like classical music, but it isn't. It's like jazz, but not quite jazz as we know it. Then there are the other moments, Camino Royale, which I always saw as a kind of homage to improvisation in the first place. A wonderful melody that Nick Magnus came up with many years ago on that one. But there comes a bit in the middle. When I originally did it, it probably sounded a bit like John Bonham meets, you know, Muddy Waters. But I've opened it out a lot of times, and it all depends on the players. If we have jazz players, it goes more jazz. If it's rock players, it goes more rock. Hopefully one day I'll do that track with an orchestra, although they're going to have a hard time staying in time on it because of the syncopation of the melody. But I think it's possibly my favorite melody ever in rock and roll, and that's what Nick came up with. I came up with the rest of the song and the chorus and blah, 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 and the lyrics and all the rest of it. But, you know, it was a kind of 50-50 thing between us. But one day I've got to try and talk the Berlin Philharmonic to see if they can get their fingers around it. Something
I was like actually going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you about bringing in string ensembles or an orchestra for that.
Yes. Well, that particular track, I think because, you know, the melody is so beautiful, you know, you can take that melody as an adagio and it would still work because harmonically it's robust. In some ways, I get the same level of joy out of it as I did from some of the moments of Genesis where you know that there was something sophisticated going on harmonically, even though the bass note may stay the same. Many, many explorations that can be done around that. And it's in that tradition. So, you know, you're right back to Bach, but then you've got syncopation and all of that. So Europe, the new world, fusion of the two, the pan-genre approach, the idea of incorporation of all these other things. So there's a whole potential symphony to be done out of that one. You know, you got that, you got the way the Hungarians see rhythm, you've got the way the South Americans see rhythm, the Argentinians, Astor Piazzolla. Very similar in a way to you know, some of the stuff that the Hungarians do, a bit like, you know, folk music with time signatures. It's very compelling. And you realize that these separate cultures all seem to have come up with the same conclusion. And I don't know why that is, but accented music, and that's something that I was brought to originally via Genesis and Phil Collins. You know, up to then I'd been, you know, pretty much blues and baroque, but then when it came to accented music, 7/8, 9/8, all of these things, we became familiar with that in a very kind of almost a bit like the sacred meets the profane. You know, Tony was very much church music and those sort of changes, and Vaughan Williams Vaughan Williams, of course, have been a great influence on Jimmy Webb. And so you've got, you know, the best of American writing and the kind of European explorations coming together. And big band work, of course, Buddy Rich, mm-hmm. all of that. And I know that all the drummers, you know, wanted to go through the Buddy Rich Book of Changes, whatever they called it, you know, his songbook. And some of that was extraordinary. You know, you can hear the fire that's in that. So I try and pay homage to them all, and the story isn't over yet. So
if I could ask,
I think music itself has got a great future. You know, whether people pick up on that in terms of, you know, this is for mass consumption, I don't know. All I know is what drives musicians.
If I could ask, so for a lot of people, when they think of Genesis, they think of, you know, the 80s hits.
Yes.
And so I've always been curious, when you left early, to be honest with you, you know, I was in the mindset in the 80s. I kind of felt like, well, the true Genesis for me was the Genesis in the 70s. And I probably for a long time was very unfair to the 80s, because they did keep some elements of prog in their album. It didn't get a lot of the radio play, but there were elements in there. But when you left, did you leave because there was the feeling that the band wanted to go more mainstream and you didn't, or did they become more mainstream because you left?
No, I think that, you know, I was very, if I can answer this in a roundabout sort of way, I was very proud of the fact that John Lennon said that he considered Genesis to be true sons of the Beatles. Now that's great. You know, you could say Beatles have been true sons of Disney by the time they'd finished with, you know, the explorations, films for the ear, cartoon influence, all of that. With Genesis, we took on board pretty much everything, a pan-genre approach. But I did an album on my own. Nobody, least of all me, expected it to be a hit. The album was a hit, and then the problem started, because even the people that had helped me make the album accused me of not giving everything to Genesis and blah, 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 blah. And so I said, well, you know, perhaps if you'd listened, yes, 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 yes. And I wasn't the only one within the ranks who had that. You know, Peter left because he wanted to have Peter Gabriel, this is, wanted to have a parallel solo career. He wanted to be a little scene, as I did. But there seemed to be, you know, this idea that, you know, it's everything being done within the ranks and not doing things outside the band. And that obviously wasn't going to work. You know, it's a pressure cooker. When you've got five writers all working together, people need to be able to work outside the band. So for any band that's you know, going somewhere usefully at this point in time, there's no point trying to sort of get people to sign up to the ethos of the band in blood. It just won't work. So eventually, of course, Genesis had to adopt that approach where everybody went off and did their own things. But, you know, it took Peter leaving and mine to leave. So there wasn't any disagreement about the musical direction. Hell, I was the first one who came up with the idea that the first hit single was based on. So I wasn't adverse to having hits, even though I'd suggested Supper's Ready, the length of it. So I was very much into long form, but I was extremely flexible about whether there should be short form or not. So it was really, I needed autonomy. I needed freedom to be able to create outside. And I worked with some wonderful people the moment that I left Genesis. But the music of Genesis was always in my heart. I'd sweated blood for it to make it in the first place. And I do think that you know, the classic period of Foxtrot meets Sally England by the Pound are probably the finest albums overall that Genesis did, where there's basically not a single weak track on the whole thing. And it's, you know, the influences range from science fiction to humor to a social comment, so many different types of things. So I think the fact that there were so many different influences is what was the strength of Genesis in the end.
That's incredible. I'm going to be at your show on the 24th in Durham, so I'm really looking forward to it. Really.
Yeah, me too. I look forward to all of these shows. You know, they are they've all been extraordinary in their own way, and I think there's a growing feeling of confidence in the band. The guys in the band know that I'm right behind them in terms of my respect and my love for what they do. That's extraordinary. And so there's a camaraderie there. Normally my name is on the top, on the poster, but you know, so many people have been involved with all of this, whether with the Genesis material or the so-called solo stuff. And we do a substantial set of so-called solo stuff, but I have lots of help on that, as I did in the past. So very happy to have group written things. I love to work with various people. I work with my wife, Jo, with Roger King. Sometimes we write as a trio. Sometimes we write as a band. Sometimes it's completely solo. It doesn't really matter where it comes from, but as long as there's inspiration at root, it seems to me. You know, there's no point having counterfeit music. I'm at the point where I don't write anything unless I hear it in my brain or someone suggests it to me. I do not substitute conscious thought and say, here we are, we can pack this in here. I'm not going to do that. But the spark has to come from somewhere magical or divine, whatever you call it, whether we are all receivers for great work from cosmic others, we don't know. I do believe in a world of spirit, and at times I do believe to an extent that I might be channeling the same spirit that may have informed some of the great stuff that was out there, because we don't know where the truly great stuff came from.
Nat Sylvan, how did you connect with him? Because I love the way that he's presenting the music.
Well, Nat is fabulous. When I first met him, he said, "Oh, I'm a bit of a chameleon," describing himself. He was able to do a great version of Peter Gabriel, a great version of Phil Collins, and he said, "You know that song you did with Richie Havens? Why don't we do that one, Icarus Ascending?" And my God, you know, when he deepens his voice, and there was one night we were doing it. I swear, it felt like he'd had a visit from Richie Havens, you know, and it sounded just like him. And I thought, my God, how is it possible to do that? So yeah, he's great and he's flamboyant, and I think he comes truly alive when he's singing this stuff. I mean, he was made to do it, born to do it, and he loves it. So when he doesn't just put those songs across, he lives those lyrics. He enacts it in the way that I think some of the best singers do that, where they're not just singing, they're transcending themselves, and they're putting across the story, because storytelling is very much central to a lot of the kind of music that you're talking about. And it's taken me a long time to figure out that a lot of the really wonderful songs that I've heard over the course of a lifetime have usually had some kind of story to them, underneath them. So, you know, whether it's a lovelorn lament sung with traditional words by a Buffy St. Marie, or whether it's a MacArthur Park, again, love and loss of love, somehow, there needs to be something that unlocks the heart and to put you in the situation. You think, yeah, I think I know what the singer's singing about now. I think I know what this song is all about.
Yes.
You might not get it when you're very, very young, but as soon as you have those early relationships and they start to go wrong, as they inevitably do, you know exactly what's being talked about.
Exactly. Like someone left the cake out in the rain.
Yeah, that's it. We'll never know exactly what those lyrics meant, but I always imagine that rain and tears was part of it, and sweetness that is not
yes.
not, omnipresent anymore. So
yes, what was it? It took so long to make it, and it took so long to bake it, and I'll never find the recipe again.
Yes, Richard Harris, and I know Richard Harris loved that.
That's a
great performance by someone who was primarily an actor, but somehow you know that he believes the lyric as he's singing.
Yes.
And there's the other section. It was a big influence on Genesis, that song, because it's not just verse, chorus. You've got an instrumental section in the middle and then a whole other section that is neither a verse nor a chorus or whatever, but it's the most philosophical of the words in the middle. It's talking about the loss of love, but then there was going to be, you know, my passion run like rivers through the sky. Where did that, you know, come from, you know? And again, I think it's romance of place as much as romance of person. So it becomes wider. And that's what I like very much about Jimmy Webb's stuff. I mean, the Genesis guys, the classic lineup of Genesis, we were all asked by Melody Maker at the time, what was our favorite single? And four out of five of us, without conferring, chose MacArthur Park.
That's
And I didn't know that they held that song in such high esteem. So obviously we were meant to all be together.
Well, you know, the thing about that is you mentioned Jimmy Webb. Now, that song. But then you have like Wichita Lineman. That on the surface you go, why is he writing a song about somebody working on a utility pole?
Yes.
When you dig deep into the lyrics and Glenn Campbell singing it, it takes it to a whole nother level. It's an incredible song.
Well, it seems as if, you know, there's a lot of poetry and metaphor in there and those wonderful harmonic changes. And I gather that thing was written in a weekend, pretty much to order. And it's a wonderful tune. It was impeccably sung. And the other thing about Jimmy Webb is the fact that he was doing those arrangements, you know, for all of the instruments. And those two songs have got extraordinary changes.
Emotional songs. And I think that's why I say I find it, I can definitely see the tie into where it would be an influence in, you know, the creativity, because, you know, there's a lot of metaphors in there. And as you said, a lot of emotion, and it goes different directions. And
It's wonderful stuff. It's transcendent. Yeah. And I will always love it. And it's, you know, memories of a certain time, of course, because music is always, and memories of music, the emotional calendar that you know exactly who your friends were at that time. It seems to define that. If I hear a song like Painted Black by the Stones, one of their few non-blues based things, you know that there's great writing there, and perhaps the sad loss of the unnamed woman, who I suspect was Patti d'Arbenville. But if I ever get to hook up with Mick Jagger again, I'll say, was that about her, that song? What was that all about? You know, was it the same person that Cat Steven was writing about? The great mystery of the 1960s before I was professional.
I need to ask a question for my daughter. She just texted me to remind me, because if I don't, she's going to smack me up the head. So I had sent her your song Natalia from Surrender of Silence. So she's a classically trained musician, so we love to talk about classical. And love the Russian composers. So both she and I love the tip of the hat. Obviously, you know, listening to it, you can hear the tip of the hat to Prokofiev, Stravinsky.
Tchaikovsky.
Yes, that was one of her questions. Okay, was that a tip to Tchaikovsky and Sugar Plum Fairy?
Deliberate, yes. Yep.
Well, she was curious, what other are you citing in there? Like, I could feel at times some Shostakovich, but I don't know if you were channeling them, but it's just that energy. So were there other composers in there?
I wasn't thinking specifically of that, but but there is some wonderful Shostakovich stuff. The Russian spirit is what we were trying to and with a few clues in there, you know, yes, referencing a couple of Tchaikovsky things, Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy.
Was the Rite of Spring specific for a reason? She was curious about Rite of Spring.
Yeah, funnily enough, I think that was subliminal.
Really?
And that's what drives the middle section. But I think it was the flagship song of the album Surrender of Silence. And I am proud of the arrangement. It was my wife, Jo, who came up with the lyric, and then we came up with the name of the character together, the idea of the Russian every woman at different stages of Russia's development and suppression and all the rest. But the penny didn't drop how to do the tune until I thought Prokofiev. If we do something in the style of the heavyweight, obviously referencing the Romeo and Juliet Prokofiev stuff, Montagues and Capulets, and then the, you know, the couple of Tchaikovsky things, Stravinsky certainly, yes, but also, you know, we might be 2 or 3 minutes in before you hear a note of rock guitar. I deliberately held back, and it was going to be the first track on the album. And I thought, you know, people will be expecting something of a rock guitarist. They won't necessarily be thinking of a heavyweight orchestra on this thing. But I love what we did with the orchestration on it. I'm very, very proud of that. Yeah,
it's a great piece.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked it, and I'm glad you've picked up on it. Yeah, I mean, it was the flagship for that album, which was done in lockdown. I think it was the first track ever written for that album. Yeah,
look at that, Steve! Unbelievable. Can I just do you have like a minute or two, or do you have to go? Because I wanted to ask.
No, I think in a couple of minutes, because I have to pack the suitcase. Literally,
you have to go, door, right? Let me just say this again. Your show goes all the way through. You're in. I said Connecticut tonight, then New York, Harrisburg, Providence, Collingswood, New Jersey for three nights.
Yes.
Durham, where Dean will see you. Charleston, Atlanta, Nashville, Cincinnati, Akron, Chicago, Milwaukee, Des Moines, Seattle, Salem, Monterey, San Diego, San Francisco, Santa Barbara, L.A. So if you're in any of those cities, get tickets and go see Steve, because it's unlike anything you've ever seen. He's tremendous live. But I wanted to bring this up, Steve, before you go. Kind of a tip to 50 years ago this happened.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen this. Since you're doing Foxtrot.
Yes.
In your second set.
Yeah.
Can I play a clip for you real quick before you leave?
Okay. Sure.
We're going to go back in time. I found this and I went, oh, this is wild. Because it's Halloween.
Right. Okay.
And I got to share this with everybody here. So I'm going to, let me see if this plays here. So this is Watcher of the Skies. And you did this at Shepperton Studios. Out on 16 millimeter. If you remember this now.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen this back, actually. They only ever show one clip from it, which is, I don't know what I like, but there you go.
Well, this segment here has you in it, like with you and the band here, all in get up. It is all in them. Let me hit mute here so it doesn't echo, and then we'll let Steve go get ready to travel on his bus down to New London. Let's watch a little of this here. This is from Watcher of the Skies, the Foxtrot album. Here we go. I had to do that. It's so wild to see that so long ago, Steve. Oh my God. That, do you remember that night?
Well, I remember, yes, we recorded that in front of an invited audience at Shepperton and one of the sound stages. So Shepperton is a film studio that brought a lot of those Ealing comedies and all that sort of British stuff, if you're aware of that, 1950s stuff. So Shepperton was riding high, back, I think, possibly more in the 1950s than 60s. But, it was a huge facility. And, we had an invited audience. And normally there's only one track, as I said, that gets showed, which is the bit from, Pete doing the... At 1 o'clock, it's time for lunch, the lawnmower thing. I know what I like, our first hit single. So I don't think I've ever seen that back, that moment there. But it's...
Memories. It's 50 years. I can't believe it.
Like, it's a mere 50 years ago. but there we are. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just about that age of that song.
But it's a great track. I think it comes across with more power now, perhaps.
I can't wait.
We have now with the band that I think do a wonderful job of bringing that stuff to life, plus the newer stuff. And so I'm very proud of this.
I can't wait.
I'm excited to see it.
The album from this show that we're doing, it went to number two in the rock charts in the UK. So just hooked up with Chris Lord-Alge, who mixed it yesterday.
Nice.
And I just, I don't think he was aware that it had gone to number two, which is great. So
look at you. I love it, Steve.
It's wonderful that music that's vintage still resonates. So I think that it's still current in a way. It's a little bit.
I think even more so now.
Hell freezes over. It seems as if it never really goes away.
No, I think even more so now. You're starting to see generations of kids coming up wanting that back. So yes, it's a beautiful thing. You're going to see in your crowd probably some young faces again.
Yes. Yeah. We see young faces. Hell, we even get women. That's unheard of in prog. There must be a romance of something.
My daughter will be there with me. So yeah.
Oh, good. There you are. See.
There you go. Well, Steve, thank you.
For men. Okay.
Yes. Thank you so much. Be safe, and we'll be watching you.
All the best. Thanks, guys. Steve. Love you talking to you.
Been an honor. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Take care now.